Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Gulf Offshore Company against Mobil Oil. Are you out of this one, Father? You're out of this one.
That's after my time.
Kennedy, you may proceed when you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, we're here today on a writ of certiorari to the Texas Court of Civil Appeals, 14th Judicial District, in a matter raising two issues. First is an issue of subject matter jurisdiction of the courts of the state of Texas to consider and try and hear cases arising under the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act. The second issue is an issue involving the applicability of this court's ruling in the case of Liepelt, which finds the juries are knowledgeable taxpayers of this country, and I'm paraphrasing, and that therefore the trial court has the duty of performing and providing instructions to the jury as to the effect of federal income taxation on jury damage awards. I'd like to first turn briefly to what I feel is the threshold question, and that is the question of subject matter jurisdiction to allow the courts of the many states to take jurisdiction over matters arising on the Outer Continental Shelf. In 1953, the Outer Continental Shelf was becoming a very vital area. The Congress of this country felt at that time that there must be a necessity for jurisdiction over this developing area. This is not a situation of the Congress going into a state and buying land or taking land away from an already existing state. This had already been laid to rest in this court's opinion in United States versus California. California had claimed ownership of the titles. The state found that the United States had paramount jurisdiction over the titles. Because of the historic nature of the state's claim to rights in the Thailand areas, Congress passed also in 1953 the Submerged Lands Act, which ceded to the states that area laying offshore of their land areas that had historically been claimed by the states.
Do you think the 53 Act was primarily thought of in terms of personal injury jurisdiction?
No, Your Honor. I think it was thought of to encompass the entire activities on the Outer Continental Shelf beyond the Submerged Land Act ceding of rights to territorial waters of the state. The personal injury aspect of this case comes up incidental. This is really a case involving a contractual dispute between the Poole Corporation, who is a drilling contractor, and Mobil Oil Company, who was the lessee or leasor of the area that was being drilled. The plaintiff in the case below was an employee of Poole Corporation, employee of my client. Under the basis of the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act, Mr. Gaddicke, the plaintiff, sole remedy against Poole Corporation was under the Longshoremen and Harbor Workers Compensation Act, which is definitely adopted as the exclusive remedy of employees on the Outer Continental Shelf. The Longshoremen Hard Workers Compensation Act also recognizes the right of third-party suits by such employees under Section 905B, if it happens to be due to the negligence of a vessel, or under Section 33, if it's due to any other type of third-party action. So this all, the plaintiff's primary claim, had to arise under the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act and under the Longshoremen Hard Workers Compensation Act as thereby extended. We move into an area where, because of international implications, the government had severe reservations of attempting to take sovereignty beyond the state's historical territorial limits. They adopted the procedure as set out in the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act, which was a horizontal extension of jurisdiction of the federal government to cover the subsoils, seabeds, and any artificial islands constructed thereon. The Act specifically did not attempt to take on any jurisdiction over the high seas, leaving that to the Maritime and Admiralty Courts. The Act itself, after first providing for this extension of jurisdiction, then turned its attention to what laws would be applicable in this Outer Continental Shelf area, in this new area of jurisdiction for the federal government. They said that they first gave, well, pardon me, they first said that federal law and regulations are applicable. They delegated to the Secretary of the Interior the right to promulgate rules and regulations, which were made applicable. Then, in order to fill any particular potential gaps or voids in the federal law as it existed at that time, they said that we are going to adopt, as federal law, the law of the adjacent state.
You're paraphrasing.
I'm paraphrasing, John,
three,
yes.
And four of your briefs.
Yes. And they said, in my paraphrasing of this, that if there is a void, if Congress has not acted, or if there has been no rule or regulation promulgated by the Secretary of Interior, then to fill these voids, we will adopt, or we will have a surrogate federal law, the law of the adjacent state. But in the Act itself, and I think the Act itself clearly shows that there is exclusive jurisdiction. Well, they put a caveat. Pardon me.
I was just going to say, it's on page 3 of your brief, section B of the statute says the United States District Courts shall have original jurisdiction of cases and controversies. It does not say original and exclusive. And
no.
Certainly in FELA cases and in 1983 cases, the federal courts are the primary forum, but nonetheless, state courts can entertain 1983 actions, and it's my understanding that state courts can entertain FELA actions.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And I think you have to look to the enactment in its entirety to see the congressional scheme. And after we get through that, I think the congressional scheme within the Act itself will be sufficient. But even if you get beyond that, then you look at the legislative intent, which I will go into in a minute. The caveat that was put in the Act in subsection A2, after they say we'll adopt state law as surrogate federal law, says all applicable laws shall be administered and enforced by the appropriate officers and courts of the United States.
But again, it doesn't say exclusive.
No.
But you want us to read it that way.
Yes, Your Honor. Because I think this is a clear congressional intent.
In our own Article 3 jurisdiction, As you no doubt know, the provision is with respect to some kind of cases, our jurisdiction is original and exclusive, and with respect to others, it's just original but not exclusive.
That's right. The reason why I think the Congress did not feel compelled to include the word exclusive, and as we'll discuss later, in the 1978 amendments to this act, even dropped out the word original, was because this was an area where there was no concurrent jurisdiction, where the states had no jurisdiction until the federal government went out and said, we are taking jurisdiction over this area. And therefore, the word original and the word exclusive.
But a state court is generally a court of general jurisdiction, and if one party from Venezuela sues another party from Holland over an accident that happened 500 miles out at sea, unless there's some federal prohibition or statutory enactment prohibiting it, the federal court can take jurisdiction of the state court can take jurisdiction of that, can't it?
I think, well, of course, we're getting out to sea. I think we're getting into an entirely different area where we're getting into the Admiralty and Maritime Courts and whether the states have any jurisdiction between foreign nationals on the high, for injuries on the high sea. My recollection is it's exclusively federal at that point. When you have foreign nationals on the high sea.
How about Bremen versus Zepeda?
The federal courts took jurisdiction over that. It was a federal court case arising in Admiralty, I believe. In subsection 3 of the same portion of the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act, I think to even further confirm what the congressional intent was, they say that the adoption of the state law as a law of the United States shall never be interpreted as a basis for claiming any interest in or any jurisdiction on behalf of any state for any purpose over the seabeds and subsoil of the Outer Continental Shelf, which I find very exclusive in its...
But it says that the provisions of this section, it doesn't say it excludes provisions or existing law that may be found in other sections.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know of any existing law at the time of the passage of the 1953 Act that gave any general jurisdiction to state courts or what happens on the high seas or at that time the Outer Continental Shelf. Prior to 1953, there was no Outer Continental Shelf as we know it now. It was all high seas. This was just the ground under the high seas. The congressional intent is clear from a reading of the legislative history. The report of the Senate Committee on Interior and Insular Affairs, which is the majority report, the court recalled this case, this act came first up through the House, was sent to the Senate. The Senate deleted practically all of the House Act, substituted their own. The Commerce Committee accepted it, and then it became law. So therefore, the report of the Senate Committee was actually the majority report and stated that the purpose of the bill was to assert the exclusive jurisdiction and control of the federal government of the United States over the seabeds, subsoils, and artificial islands. They said that we're going to carry out this primary purpose of the measure, the exerting of exclusive jurisdiction, by developing a body of law which is going to extend exclusively to this area. This body of law is going to consist of the Constitution and the laws and the civil and political jurisdiction of the federal government. Next, it's going to incorporate the regulations, rules, and operating orders of the Secretary of Interior. And three, in the absence of any applicable federal law or adequate secretary regulation, the civil and criminal law of the state adjacent would be adopted as federal law. So here again, they knew exactly what they were doing.
Is there any reason why the Texas state courts can't apply federal law the way they do under FELA and under 1983?
I think you have to look at the compelling reasons for this Outer Continental Shelf, under the Outer Continental Shelf Act itself. Jurisdiction could have been ceded by the federal government to state government. I think in a situation such as this, since we have no concurrent jurisdiction to begin with, or no state jurisdiction over this area to begin with, it would have taken an enactment by Congress ceding it back, as they did in the Submerged Lands Act, saying, okay, Mr. Louisiana, Mr. Texas, we give you the right over this area.
Isn't there an intermediate ground where you don't cede the cede the territory back, but you say that federal law may be applied in the courts of the adjacent state?
But there's nothing in the Act to indicate that this was the intent of Congress. In fact, the minority people definitely recognize that this was not the intent of Congress. Congress wanted the adjacent states to have nothing to do with control of this area on the Outer Continental Shelf because of all the international implications that were then involved. Congress was obviously worried at that time that there was going to be a hue and outcry from our world friends that we were trying to take over the sovereignty of this seabed area. And that's why they were so careful in placing this, I feel, in the hands of the federal government to rule and regulate without interference from the many states. We're talking about not just one or two states that might have an interest in it. The Outer Continental Shelf extends, of course, completely around the continental United States, varying in size from 250 miles off of the New England coast to 50 to 150 miles in the Gulf of Mexico to as little as 5 to 40 miles off California. Then when you get to Alaska, the Outer Continental Shelf is bigger than the state of Alaska itself. So this is the area that we're talking about that Congress was so deeply involved in and interested in. The Act history and the minority report, if the court will recall, Mr. Justice White has had an opportunity to review the legislative history of this Act in some length in the Rodriguez opinion. I think from a reading of that opinion, it shows a clear indication of the vesting of exclusive jurisdiction in federal courts. As noted by Mr. Justice White, states that, on the other hand, federal enforcement of the law in this area was insisted upon by the Department of Justice, and there was substantial doubt whether state law and jurisdiction could or should be extended to these structures. A federal solution was thought necessary. The legislative history, one thing I think should be pointed, was this act was fought and fought bitterly by the senators from Louisiana, senators from Texas, but primarily led by the senators from Louisiana. Senator Ellender, the senior senator from Louisiana, offered an amendment where, and described in his own words, "My amendment is very simple. It would clarify a multiplicity of problems which are bound to arise. It would give coastal states the right to extend their jurisdictions to these lands. For what purposes? Merely for the purpose of administering the criminal and civil laws which may appertain to that area." And this amendment was defeated by Congress. To again re-urge it, Senator Long from Louisiana filed a subsequent amendment trying to get Congress to adopt it, accepting for the most part, all of Senator Ellender's original amendment, but deleting any possibility of confusion that the amendment may in some way provide for taxing powers in the state. Well, maybe that was what Congress was looking at, just simply that they were afraid this was going to give the state taxing powers. So he specifically deletes that, Senator Longdes, and that amendment was defeated after floor argument. Senator Long then submitted another amendment. It was a compromise amendment with the majority leaders and simply added the word adjacent state to what law would be adopted as federal law, because the original act said just the nearest point of land the law would apply. So they put in this adjacent state rule instead of the nearest point of land. And that is what was finally enacted. Senator Long filed the minority report and recognized in his minority report that there was no state court jurisdiction as far as this act was concerned. And that was his reason for his minority report. He was still unhappy and dissatisfied with the congressional action. So I think there's clear legislative intent as to what Congress was proposing to do. Now, this case, in 25 years, up to 1978, this legislation had only been piecemealed and added to in a piecemeal sort of way. In 1978, there was a codification of various laws and rules of various regulations into what's been referred to as the 1978 amendments. I'd simply like to point out, as far as I'm concerned, the 1978 amendments did not in any way change the jurisdictional approach. It was simply a recodification.
Did these accidents take place on artificial islands?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, then don't you have some trouble with Rodrigue, on which you rely on the passage that says a compromise emerged that federal law would prevail, but that the states would have some jurisdiction to apply that federal law on artificial islands?
I don't believe Rodrigue, Your Honor, in Rodrigue that is at all the holding. Was this a maritime case or was this an outer continental shelf lands case?
Well,
did the maritime law
in Rodrigue, it says on page 365, but the special relationship between the men working on these artificial islands and the adjacent shore to which they commute to visit their families was also recognized by dropping the treatment of these structures as vessels, and instead over the objections of the administration that these islands were not really located within a state, the bill was amended to treat them as if they were in an area of exclusive federal jurisdiction located within a state.
That
page 365.
The whole approach there is the applicable law. This was the question in Rodrigue. What is the applicable law? And the applicable law, as recognized by Rodrigue, is going to be federal law, and they do not adopt Admiralty and Maritime Law. That was the effect of it. And they simply go back and reiterate the standards of law that's applied under the Act. First, federal law, second, rules and regulations of the Secretary of Interior, and then if there is no applicable federal law, then you look to the law of the adjacent state, not as state law, not as an Erie type of court, but as a federal law. And I think the 1978 amendments clearly show what has happened in this area. When you start in 1953, there were a lot of areas where there might have been voids, where there was no applicable federal law at that time, and they needed something to look to build and evolve a federal law. The 1978 amendments strengthened the control of the federal government over civil suits.
I thought you said a moment ago it was just a codification.
Well, it's a codification as far as all of these piecemeal legislations that had been adopted over the 25-year period from 53 to 78, these were recodified into this one act. A lot of the rules and regulations were referred to and brought into the act. But really, then it strengthens it, if I may point out the strengthening. It provided that there was a law and suit in federal court to compel compliance with the act and with any regulations. Now, there might have been a void there, so that they felt they had to do that. But even more important, as a second item, they provided a suit for damages to any resident who is in any manner injured, reading in personal injury or any other type of injury, due to an operator's, such as my people, noncompliance with a rule, regulation, or permit issued pursuant to the Act. And in connection with what has been referred to as a citizen suit, they granted an award of attorney's fees to be added on to the damages, and they granted the award of witness fees.
Let me take your mind back to this instruction.
All right.
How do you think the Texas Court of Appeals viewed that instruction? As something called for under Texas law, federal law, Louisiana law?
You're referring to the light bulb instruction now, Your Honor? There's no doubt, if having tried the case, they were implying Texas law as a procedural type of law. The appellate court did not really address it in view of the Liepelt decision, because the Liepelt decision didn't come down until after the appellate court's opinion. I can't say that I really know what was in the judge's mind. It was just, as the record will reflect, one of the big issues. I was representing a third-party defendant. Did I even have a right to raise this issue? Did I ever have a right to ask for this instruction?
Don't you think we should know or have some idea
as to whether this is Texas law? I don't. Well, of course, Texas law would not even apply in this case, Your Honor. Even if you say that the state courts have jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, this happened off the coast of Louisiana.
Well, is it clear now that this kind of an instruction could be given under federal law?
I think it's very clear.
But it wasn't then.
It was not at that time. But it's been referred to that you'd have to be omnipotent to ever have decided the Supreme Court would do what they did. I say this is not true. This is an instruction that we've been fighting for and asked for years. And if I'm no more omnipotent than any other defense attorney, and it's an instruction that I think felt had to be asked for under the federal law. We knew we were dealing with federal law.
And you did ask for the instruction.
We did ask for the instruction. It was refused. The instruction that I asked for is almost right in line with the instruction that was in the Liepelt case.
You anticipated the Liepelt decision, in effect, didn't you?
Well, I didn't really anticipate the Liepelt decision, but I knew sooner or later that the law had to recognize the fact that juries were continuously being confused by the fact that nobody would tell them what effect taxes had on it. And I would like to make one thing clear. It is our position that the Liepelt opinion simply requires an instruction by the judge to the jury that they should neither take it, neither increase nor delete anything from their award because of federal income tax, and that the award is not subject to federal taxation. I think this is what the court has done in the Liepelt.
So what if we disagree with you on the jurisdictional question, on the jurisdiction of the state courts, but agree with you on the instruction?
Then I think the case should be reversed and remanded.
Be a new trial?
Huh?
Would it be a new trial then?
Remanded, yes.
On liability or damages or what?
At least on damages.
But, of course, if we agreed with you on the first, it would wipe out the entire.
Yes, Your Honor.
But,
now, this
the jury set the damages.
Is what?
The jury found the damages here.
The jury found the damages.
All in one proceeding.
All in one proceeding. There has been no appeal taken from the jury's award against Mobil. Mm-hmm. The only appeal that's before this court is on Mobil's claim over against us for indemnity.
Mm-hmm.
But if we disagree with you on the jurisdictional issue and conclude that the state courts do have jurisdiction, might it not also follow that the state courts can apply their own rules of damages? And in which event they might not have to give the Liefeld instruction?
If not, as long as it's inconsistent with the federal law. This is not applying state law as an Erie court would. The Abercrombie Shelf Lands Act is perfectly clear that it is federal law.
Is there a federal measure of damages and things like mental suffering and loss of consortium and all that? Are there federal rules of damages?
There is about taxes. There is about interest. I'd refer the court.
No, but, you know, some of these, like the Death on the High Seas Act and all, there have been different rules of damages, whether it's state or federal.
Rodriguez thrown that out, says that is not applicable.
So there's no federal rule of damages applicable with respect to just the measure of damages, putting aside taxation for the moment.
There may be in certain areas, Your Honor, and I can't really answer it all. I know that as the interest on awards on judgment, like in the Amon opinion out of the Fifth Circuit, that there is a federal law. Liefeld, there is a federal law. So
there is now.
At least there is. Right.
Your time is expired.
Thank you,
Mr. Kennedy. Mr. Caton.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, the objective of the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act was clearly stated in the Presidential Proclamation, 1945, in the Congressional Record, and in the Act itself. It says specifically that what we are dealing with is the resources in the shelf. And that is what the states and the federal government were fighting over, the resources. They gave no deliberate attention to what court would have jurisdiction over these disputes arising on the act, on the shelf. No one has taken the position on the respondent side of the aisle that we are asking that the courts of the states have sole jurisdiction of these cases. The administration complained about those provisions in the Act originally, which would provide, apparently, for sole jurisdiction in the state courts. And they insisted that the Act be amended so as to provide that you will treat those fixed structures, those fixed platforms, as if they were an area of federal enclave. That's what they were to be treated as an area of federal jurisdiction located within a state. We say that falls directly in line with this court's opinion expressed by Justice Marshall in the Evans case out of the state of Maryland, when we had a federal enclave in which the voters complained that they were being deprived by the commissioners of Maryland of their voting rights. And the court's clear statement in there was that despite the fact that they were residents of a federal enclave within a state, that the state courts had jurisdiction and the state courts had process over those residents of that federal enclave. The Act says specifically that you will treat those platforms as federal enclaves. Now, the Claflin-Houseman decision, which came 1 year after the federal lower court system was established, 1876, actually addresses the very contentions which are being made by Gulf Offshore in this case. They say that jurisdiction, exclusive jurisdiction in a sovereign, follows the sovereignty, and that a state court is not entitled to have concurrent jurisdiction, and that was put to rest in Houseman specifically. Justice Story in the Martin versus Hunter case had agreed with that proposition, and it was disagreed with by this court in the opinion by Justice Bradley. And in it he said that general principle that where the state courts had historic concurrent jurisdiction, we are not going to take that away from them unless you do what Mr. Hamilton said you must do in number 82 of the Federalist Papers. He said you can only do that in three ways. You can do it by express language in the statute. You can secondly do it, if it's not express language, you can give it by express language a jurisdiction of the federal court and deny the state court's jurisdiction. That's the second way. If you can't do it either of those two ways, then you must show that the exercise of concurrent jurisdiction in the state courts is simply incompatible by the nature of the case itself with concurrent jurisdiction in the state courts. Now, from a practical standpoint, we cannot fathom why concurrent jurisdiction over outer continental shelf lands cases should not be handled by a state court. The objective of the act is not being offended in any way by state court jurisdiction. There is very little difference in the discovery rules. There is no federal specialty which has been built up over the years in Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act cases which give the federal courts some particular specialized knowledge or expertise over this type of case in any way. It's interesting to note that in Gulf Offshore's brief, they cite, in support of one of their positions, a case called In re Dearborn. That case arose off the Texas coast on a fixed platform. Five or six men were killed because of an explosion and fire. One of those men was a man by the name of Monk, whose survivors filed an action in the state district court in Texas. That case was removed to the federal district court, and it was joined with all of the other survivors' actions arising out of that case. That case went to conclusion, went through the Fifth Circuit. Cert was denied by this court. Are we now to take the position that that case, that all of the judgments entered in that case are void because that derivative jurisdiction, which the federal court had to depend on in order to hold that Monk case in its court, and I think it's clear that it is a derivative.
Well, res judicata would prevent that, would it not? Well, the Sunshine Mining against Chinese in those cases say that even though the court had jurisdiction or did not have jurisdiction when it started out, if the parties litigated the issue and let the case become final, it's over. You can't vacate it.
I agree with that, Your Honor. The point I'm really trying to make is that under the Lambert-run coal company line of cases, it's clear that a federal court cannot take jurisdiction on a removed action unless the state court had original jurisdiction of that case. Now, if that's the case, and I think that it is, then Judge Rubin, who they rely on as the only federal lower court who has held that the state courts don't have concurrent jurisdiction, he should have dismissed the Floor case because the state court, he said, didn't have jurisdiction originally. He should have simply dismissed it. And he did not do that. It's just inconsistent that he could rely on a contention that the federal court had exclusive jurisdiction and then say that the state court, that he had derivative jurisdiction out of that same state court. Now, in order to take care of the objective of developing the riches, the resources on the outer continental shelf, Congress simply passed two acts. They passed a Submerged Lands Act, which was called the Quitclaim Legislation, which gave the Gulf states a 3 marine leagues area off their low mean tide shore, and it gave the ocean states 3 statute mile area off their coasts. Then it came along in the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act case and said, now we are going to take care of two things. We are going to provide for development of those riches, and we are going to provide with what you are going to do with the revenue that you obtain from those riches. That's all they said. I think that when we get back to the Claflin versus Hausman rule, which says that unless you can meet one of the tests which were established by Mr. Hamilton, that I've already mentioned, then you cannot take away from the state courts their historic concurrent jurisdiction of these cases. Now, I don't dispute that the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act created a new statutory remedy, and we started from scratch with a federal law which we have to apply. It's surrogate federal law, but it is not a new remedy. And strangely enough, in the Hausman case, again, Mr. Bradley anticipated that, Justice Bradley, and he said specifically, that it was mentioned by Justice Story. He said it was indeed intimated by Mr. Justice Story, obiter dictum, in Martin versus Hunter, that the state courts could not take cognizance of cases arising under the Constitution, laws, and treaties of the United States, as no such jurisdiction existed before the Constitution was adopted. This is true as to jurisdiction depending on United States authority, but the same jurisdiction existed, at least to a certain extent, under the authority of the states. And then he goes on to say, the change of authority creating the right did not change the nature of the right itself. We are simply saying that this is a simple common law negligence action. The character of that right wasn't changed because the federal government declared that it had jurisdiction over that territory. And the practical question to ask then is, what is going to happen when I get this $183 sworn account case that I have in my office and I give it to a federal judge who's got 600 or 700 cases on his docket and tell him that you must rule on that case because we can't take that to the county court? If we are really looking at the pragmatic factors, because Congress didn't and we therefore have to do it, how can we be pragmatic and take the position that we are going to congest the federal court dockets more by giving them all of the cases and controversies which were traditionally handled by state courts and turn those into the hands of federal courts? That is not being pragmatic. The Act does not say exclusive. The idea that because you do not say we are granting concurrent jurisdiction to the state courts has been ridiculed many times by the treatise writers, including Professor Reddish, because that's begging the question. The fact that you do not grant concurrent jurisdiction to the state courts means nothing. You don't grant concurrent jurisdiction to the state courts, you take it away. That's what Congress does. There is no prohibition against state jurisdiction in the Act, so that you can't meet the second test that Mr. Hamilton established, and no viable or justifiable reason has been suggested why we should dump these cases on a federal district court. There is no pragmatic reason for it. I would like to say, with respect to the Liepelt decision,
well, maybe you could suggest some way we could rule that state courts have exclusive jurisdiction.
Well, that is something I'm sure that a number of judges I know would like to see happen, Your Honor.
You mean federal courts?
Federal courts. I have no preference. It's like asking a Marine in a foxhole whether he prefers strafing or bombing, which court I'm in. So I don't see any preference. I would like to say, with respect to the Liepelt decision briefly, the reason why the district court judge of the state, the trial judge, didn't have anything in his mind was because the jury didn't have anything in their minds. And they didn't have anything in their minds because they didn't have any evidence. And I'm saying that the Liepelt decision doesn't say you can give that very, whether we like it or not, that is a confusing instruction in the absence of explanation. The only explanation you can give is
was Liepelt on the books when the trial took place?
Well, Your Honor, it was on the books. It simply wasn't in the appellate books, but everybody knew that that case was about to be decided.
But it wasn't.
But the arguments that were being made in its favor were well known.
But it wasn't.
That's right. It was not binding, Your Honor.
Your argument goes at least as far as that we shouldn't decide the instruction should have been given, but why shouldn't we remand to see if the district, if the trial judge,
there's a simple
thought that this is a matter of federal law, and he should decide whether it should be given.
No, there's a very simple explanation for that. It is a matter of federal law. If it is, the federal law provides clearly that you may not give an instruction in the absence of evidence. That's not a state rule.
Well, we ought to have the district judge decide that. You're asking us to look at the record and come up with our own view of the facts.
No, Your Honor, I think
what's the evidence that's missing, Mr. Beavis?
There's no evidence, Your Honor, that they didn't. All right, I'll tell you what the evidence I think should have been put in if they wanted the instruction. They should have put in the code section which says that these awards are not subject to taxation. They should have put in 1040 instruction book. They should have put in the 1040.
The 1040 what?
The form 1040, the IRS 1040 instruction book. They should have put in the tax table. They could have at least argued with that information. It could simply been put in. They could have argued from that and explained to the jury, or better still, they could have done what the Liepelt court suggested, offer expert testimony to explain to the jury rather than to confuse them what that instruction meant. But the idea that that was a state procedural rule is accurate, but it's also a federal procedural rule. Clear decisions of this court have held that you may not give an instruction, an explanatory instruction, in the absence of clear evidence in the record. And I'm saying that the people who are complaining about the judge's failure to do that are asking the judge to give an instruction on no evidence.
So you're just saying that if we remanded for reconsideration in the light of Liepelt, it would just be a useless act.
You've given them a second chance to do what they should have done the first time, and that's offer evidence. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Jamil.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I represented Mr. Gedeke in the trial below and up to and including this point. He was injured in 1975. The act that petitioner asked this court to now construe by adding the word exclusive to was passed in 1953. It was amended in 1978. Mr. Gedeke's case did not go to trial until after the act had been amended. The act was amended in September of 1978. Mr. Gedeke's case went to trial in November of 1978. Mr. Gedeke was 30 years of age. The evidence in the case, as elicited by me from the doctors, from expert testimony, showed that his lost earnings would exceed by twice what the jury assessed as damages. He had major surgery three times, spinal surgery. It differs from, I bring this to the court's attention, to show the difference between Gedeke and Liepelt. Liepelt was this court construing a federal statute where the damages were confined to net pecuniary loss. No such test exists in Gedeke. So if the instruction is correct in Liepelt, there's no reason to extend it to a common law negligence action where pain and suffering are a major element of that cause of action damage-wise. And what other differences do we have? In Liepelt, we had the complaining party attempting to introduce evidence showing what tax brackets, the evidence regarding income tax. And then that evidence was denied by the trial judge, and he was not allowed the instruction. In this case, all we had was counsel for petitioner, after all of the evidence was closed and the case was over, handing the trial judge a piece of paper asking for an instruction. The Louisiana law forbade this. The Texas law procedurally forbade this. Liepelt had not been handed down. And we must look at this case as it existed.
What about a case in the federal court, same kind of a case as this one in the federal court that's filed and tried tomorrow? Would it be error to give the Liepelt instruction?
I believe that it would be error not to give it in a FVLA case.
Yes,
an FVLA case.
Well, I didn't ask you about that. I asked you about this kind of a case.
A common law tort action.
I'm asking you about this kind of a case that arises on the outer continental shelf and it's federal law borrowing state law, except to the extent that it's inconsistent.
I think that unless this court desires to extend the Liepelt rule to a common law tort damage element action, which it did not do in the FVLA case, because you were looking at a net pecuniary loss where income taxes may have been the instruction to give.
We're extending it to a statutory to a claim under a statute, aren't we?
Your Honor, but that's not so. This
action
was brought.
We borrow state law as federal law.
This action was brought under a common law tort. The second most important document in reply to your question.
Well, it certainly wasn't brought under state law.
The action?
Yeah.
Well, it most certainly was, Your Honor.
Well, how could it be?
Because, Your Honor, the Savings to Suitors Clause of the 1789 Judiciary Act gave him this right.
Oh,
unless
so
we're willing
saying,
to.
You're saying this Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act doesn't apply at all.
No, I'm not. It's
well, is it federal law or not that it controls this case?
It is state law, and you've so stated
no, it's
in
only
Madrid.
Borrowed. It's only borrowed. It's only it's federal law borrowing state law.
Borrowed, begged, or bought, Your Honor. It's still state law.
Well, it isn't state. It isn't the cause of action under state law, then.
It is, Your Honor.
Well, okay. You have it your way.
Well, Your Honor, unless we're ready to repeal the 1789
Judiciary
Act and
not.
The Savings to Suitors Clause, it's still state law. Well, where in the Act, and I have asked in my brief for a petitioner to point out so we would know, where in the Act does it give Mr. Gedeke or anybody else the right to bring suit? It has none. The section he refers to, Your Honor, is Section 2, which was brought about after Olson versus Shell, when Justice Brown ruled that there was no remedy under this Act. And it was put into, for one reason only, Your Honor, not common law actions. And all one need do is read it. And it says, for violations of rules or regulations, not common law. Rules and regulations are not common law. And it's very clear. We must assume, either correctly or incorrectly, that some of the members can read and write the rudimentary English language. Now, the only time exclusive appears in this Act is when it appears once, which I think adds weight to what I'm trying to say. It appears in the section, paragraph 7, under section of citizens' rights to sue. And it says when a suit is brought against the Secretary of the Interior, then jurisdiction lies in the District Court of the District of Columbia. And the appeal is exclusive to the Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia.
Well, the exclusive argument, if you're right, the exclusive argument is beside the point because it's state law. And obviously but, you're not going to have some exclusive jurisdiction in the federal court over a state law cause of action.
But we have to address it because this court does have the right to interpret that statute. And I must address myself.
So it is a cause of action under the statute?
No. It is a cause of action applying state law, and if we're going to be semantical, state law under the statute. But it's still state law, and state law forbade us to submit an income tax instruction. And another thing, procedurally, I don't believe the court has the power, if Munger versus Florida is still the law, to address itself to this question. Because under the Texas procedural law, counsel has the responsibility not only to present the issue to the court, but have it marked, refused, and made a part of the record. This was not done in this case. Issue number C, which he relies on, is not marked, refused in any way. We have no way to know whether or not the judge refused it. Procedurally, he did not comply with everything he must do in order for this court to rule on the matter. A jurisdiction, if I may again. Never do we see the word, and I would like to, original jurisdiction has meaning in only one context. That is when it is applied in relation to appellate jurisdiction. And I think that I don't need to dwell upon that. But as I can say it no better than Justice Brennan said it in Sonship versus Pennsylvania. If counsel's argument is the exclusion of the word original then made it necessary for you to interpret it as meaning exclusive, then that is a tour de force of statutory interpretation, and I begged and borrowed the words from Justice Brennan.
Mr. Jemam, may I get back to the Leipold question again?
Yes, sir.
I gather, or do I correctly understand your argument, even if this case were tried today after Leipold's decision here, you'd be arguing just as you are now?
I would have to because Leipold was talking about an APLA case.
I know. That's what I'm trying to get to.
Yes.
You'd be arguing that no Leipold instruction was required, notwithstanding the cases tried after Leipold.
Yes, and I hope and pray that that's what this court will write.
Well, you would say it would be error to give it. Not only that it wasn't required, it would be error to give it.
If the, I think it would be under the existing Louisiana law as it was at the time, Justice White, because we had case law, Louisiana law, and incidentally, there is no confusion under which law this case was tried under. The Court of Civil Appeals emphatically states it was tried under Louisiana law, and it was, using the Texas rules of procedure, which we were required to do. Now, I'm saying, Your Honor, when I, and I don't want to be misunderstood, and I certainly don't want to be crosswise with you. I need, this is, the only one who gets hurt in this is Mr. Gedeke. Look at the miscarriage of justice.
Nothing wrong with being crosswise.
Oh,
a lot of people are.
I'm crosswise with too many people already. But let me say this to you, and seriously so. What happens to poor Mr. Gedeke? The respondent lays back until the statute of limitations runs and then says, you don't have any jurisdiction over here. And then he comes here and says, no jurisdiction. Now, what happens to Mr. Gedeke? The court can say, well, we will rely on the Justice Potter Stewart's opinion in Chevron versus Husson, which said that, well, it would be too harsh and too unjust to send it back now because where's his remedy? But I'm not relying on that. This is not a, I'm saying the law itself, the act itself, imposes no exclusive jurisdiction. I hope that that's been made clear, and hopefully this court will not, by judicial fiat, say, all right, we're going to say exclusive jurisdiction. And incidentally, the character of what happened, we can't listen to floor debates by senators and congressmen who are interested in glomming off some of the profits from the undersea belt. What you've got to do is take it in context. What did the explanation committee of the floor managers of the bill tell us? What does that teach us? It says nothing in this act shall ever be construed to put a limit on anyone's remedy for injury or death. Now, again, we must assume Congress can read and write English. Some may not, but here we must. They said what they wanted to say. They had two cracks at it to say exclusive, and both times turned it down, originally and in the amendment. But back to Liepelt. If the court is going to extend Liepelt, then I'm asking the court to do it in a sunburst sort of way and not make it retroactive for the harshness that would result to this man, simply because the case was tried as it had to be of necessity under the rules that existed at the time. And both Louisiana substantive law and Texas procedural law forbade its inclusion in Texas substantive law. He's not properly before this court on the issue of Liepelt. Unless you want to overrule Monger versus Florida. And that's made clear in our brief. And I can only hope that the court will not inflict us, who have to try lawsuits, with the further burden, as counsel for respondents suggests, a new body of federal law. What's it going to be called? Nobody intended that. It's already very difficult to try one of these cases. And the courts, everyone, I think, will agree that the courts below are doing all they can to interpret. I think whatever happens ought to be a clear enunciation. First, that there is no exclusivity in the federal court for this type of action, for if there had meant to be, Congress would have told us so. Secondly, that we will not further encroach on state jurisdiction by judicial fiat. And thirdly, that we will not extend Liepelt beyond what it was intended to do. For what is a jury to do with an instruction without evidence? Are they to go in and then sit back in the jury room and say, well, I wonder what bracket he'll be in? Will somebody go to the phone and call H.R. Block? Maybe he can help us. What do we do with this? It's already enough confusion. I say that there must be evidence. And if the court is just going to issue a UCAS, a decree that says evidence or not, the instruction should be granted. Then what? How do we do this in the face of the Penrod cases, Starnes and Johnson cases, where the court has ruled, and I was the lawyer that tried those also, unfortunately, that inflation cannot be considered. Well, what is more speculative than what is going to happen to us tax-wise? Is inflation more speculative? It's omitted because even evidence is omitted in a diversity case, which that was. So I'm asking this court to confine Liepelt to what it's meant to be, the interpretation of a federal statute, in a death case at that, where the net pecuniary loss is the damage issue involved, and not to insert it into the common law tort action where there are other elements of damages, and certainly to hold that there's no jurisdiction and to consider the fact of the injustice that will occur to Gedeke if this case is reversed. And if this court holds that exclusive jurisdiction lies in the federal court.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.